This episode is brought to you by Trade Coffee.
This week on Retronauts, it's a Retronauts about Retronauts. Everybody, welcome to another episode of Retronauts. I'm your host for this one, Bob Mackey, and this week's topic is the 15th anniversary mailbag. Yes, that's correct, because as of October 4th, 2021, Retronauts is now 15 years old, which means we're currently in our 16th year of podcasting. And if you didn't know this, we covered the origins of Retronauts with some very special guests for the 10th anniversary back in episode 78. But this time around, we're going to reflect on our independent years, where we are now, and read and respond to your questions and comments. So who's here with me today?
It's me, Jeremy Parrish, here to celebrate the Retronauts quinceanera.
He's the perfect guy.
Take me back to the old days of living in West Texas and celebrating my friend's 15th anniversary or 15th birthdays.
You know, I've never been to one. Should we have some sort of food out or something here? Like what's the normal like catering?
There should definitely be a mariachi band.
Okay.
That is a thing that is done. Food wise, you know, whatever tastes good.
I will edit in some mariachi music throughout this episode to make it feel more fitting. But yes,
Thank you.
Now we have grown from girls into women. Is that how that works?
That is correct.
Okay, yes. Excellent. So Jeremy's here, of course, obviously. Jeremy's here. Just me and Jeremy for this one, for this celebration. And I want to bring up some fun stats first, Jeremy. Fun and scary stats. So I did some math. And okay. We're just talking about the independent year starting in 2013. So I want to let everyone know just how many things we've done so far. So this is episode 420. And then we have 27 episodes of Retronauts Pocket and 95 episodes of Retronauts Micro. Towards the end, the micros are getting to be as long as regular episodes. So counting all of our total releases, we have made 542 podcasts, not counting any non-numbered ones that happen to be in our feed. Because I know there was a few live shows that aren't numbered, a few specials that aren't numbered. But yeah, close to 550, let's say. So that's a lot. We've eclipsed everything that was done on 1UP, both in terms of years and episodes. So 542, that's a lot.
It is really a lot of podcasts. That's a lot of talking, really.
It really is. And I just know that means if you or I pass away at some point in the future, it's probably going to happen. They can reconstruct everything we've ever said, because I think we have each recorded every word in the human language at this point.
That's true. They've got lots of phenomes to work from.
Yes. So I want my hologram to be appearing at future podcast conventions, like a PRGE 2050, let's say. let's be more hopeful. 2060, you can meet Bob Mackey's hologram next to a very...
Yeah, I mean, I plan to be out on the road, you know, when I'm 80 or so.
Mm-hmm. It's the only thing we'll be able to do by then. But I want to talk...
I can talk about old video games, nothing else.
It's the only thing I can do, which is why I'm here. So I want to talk about, Jeremy, where we've been since we restarted the podcast independently. We moved to Patreon, everything that's happened since then. So a brief memory refresher. So we were at this website called oneup.com. Sometimes it's still online. Sometimes it isn't. It depends on the weather, what the mood the server is in. But it once existed in a complete format. OneUp shut down in February of 2013. And then Jeremy, myself and Ray Barnhill got together and kickstarted Retronauts. And by July of 2013, that is when the podcast formally started. And outside of one kind of hiatus between the Kickstarter and the Patreon seasons, we have just done this nonstop for the past nearly 9 years.
Pretty much, yeah. You know, I had a... This is honest, God's honest truth. I had a dream last night when I was in the middle of, like... you know, recovering from a simultaneous COVID booster and a flu shot, and just like having intense sleep and night sweats, I dreamed that I stopped at the IGN offices to visit Kat Bailey to talk about something. And while I was there, I stumbled into a staff meeting where they were announcing that all video game publications were being shut down and handed me a pink slip for Retronauts.
Huh.
I was like, you can't do this. Retronauts is independent.
If you ever,
you know, these memories have stuck with me. These scars go deep.
If you ever have a chance to visit the office, Jeremy, you need to find the 1UP server and just whack it with something, because it's somewhere in that building, as far as I know. It can't be offsite.
Yeah, I don't know. It's probably like just, you know, an old Mac 2CE or something, you know, from 1988, running in a closet underneath the table. You know, they laid off the guy, the only guy who cared about the server. So, of course, you know, you get rid of that person. And he did it. Michael Zacks, you know, kept it going for a while out of the goodness of his heart. But eventually it was just like, I don't owe these people anything. By these people, he meant, you know, Ziff Davis and IGN. So, yeah, good relations.
If we can raise enough money to get him to receive an IT person salary, I think we can restart 1UP. Other than that, I have all of my articles on Google Docs, and that's all I can tell you.
I mean, I actually made a serious business proposal to buy the name 1UP.com and restart the site after they shut it down. Like, I put together funding and everything. We're talking, like, you know, potential multi-million dollar deal to acquire all this stuff. But they were just like, no, that's too valuable. So then they proceeded to sit on their asses and do nothing with it for 8 years.
And that's where we are today.
You know, business with Ziff Davis.
Yes.
Good, smart people.
A great company that deserves to still exist. And yeah, 1UP shut down in spring of 2013, and we went to Kickstarter. And I will say, upon retrospection or reflection, rather, Kickstarter, not the best way to fund a podcast, because the whole lump sum thing works for some kind of projects, but I feel like, especially if you're new to funding this kind of thing, it was a struggle kind of to figure out, like, you know, how do we pay for this? How much do we pay ourselves? I don't think we were paying ourselves anything really from the Kickstarter. I don't think we took anything personally.
We got a pittance.
Yeah, I think
I paid for an extra week's stay in a very inexpensive Japanese hotel when I was at Tokyo Game Show. That's what I bought with that. That was like $900 of hotel. That was my personal take from the Kickstarter.
The very first year was a labor of love. It was all of us working for free, basically, even though, you know, travel was paid for and our food was paid for when we would travel. And, you know, we rented our studio with that money. But luckily, Patreon became a very viable form for funding podcasts, although the platform was not ready for podcasts until a few years after we actually joined. So not all of our podcasts are actually in the RSS feed, because they did not have RSS feeds until maybe about a year or so after we joined Patreon in 2014. But we were some of the first people there for podcasts.
Yeah, the you know, I'm frustrated that, you know, especially you and Bob ended up basically doing the Kickstarter stuff for free, because that was never the intention. You guys were out of work, so I wanted this to be like a way for you guys to make some money after getting unceremoniously laid off by large corporations. And that didn't really pan out. So I've always felt bad about that. But Patreon has proven, you know, like a way for us to actually be able to afford food and healthcare and things like that, which is
nice. It's great.
And I had kind of tested the waters in advance with my video projects.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so I kind of, you know, put that out there and figured out over the course of a few years, like, what's the best way to do this? And sort of midway through that process, we came into Patreon, and, you know, so there was still a learning process for podcasts involved, but I kind of, you know, experimented with like an a la carte approach, where I wasn't sure how frequently I was going to publish. So then people would support me by paying per episode that I posted. But then I got really kind of doing it on a regular basis and realized, like, man, this is really going to, you know, rip some people's, you know, their bank accounts if I keep going like this. So I changed it to a, like, just, you know, support me for X amount per month. And I think that's the way most people do things, unless they are very sporadic. You know, that seems to be a good way to go. And I continue to be grateful for just the fact that this platform exists. I'm not totally happy about all of Patreon's business maneuvers and decisions, especially once the venture capitalists came in and said, oh, you have to do things, you know, in the capitalistic way. But, you know, Patreon was basically a realization of a kind of an idle wish that I had, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, thinking, I wish there were like a setup kind of like the Renaissance, you know, patron system, where someone wealthy would say, hey, Michelangelo, come paint ceilings for me, and basically I'll pay for you to exist. And you know, I thought it would be really cool to have something like that for creating media, but that would never work. And then Patreon came along and was basically that, but kind of dispersed among, you know, not lots of wealthy people, but many people who have just normal incomes, who make it possible for us to do stuff and have a normal income by doing things that large companies wouldn't really pay us for.
It's great to know, and very satisfying to know, that if you're at a website, you can write an article that makes, I don't know, 100,000 hits, 500,000 hits, and still get laid off. But with a Patreon, my experience has been you basically need 2,000 people to support you, and you can live in the Bay Area of all places, like one of the most expensive places to live. And that's been very fulfilling to me, where I can worry about, you know, entertaining my audience and giving them what they want, and not worry about, you know, I need to write about Game of Thrones today or whatever the next topic is. And as far as the platform goes, I don't know how much you would disagree with me on this one, Jeremy, but not just saying this because they're my sole source of income, but I've been very happy with Patreon. And the few times they've messed up, they really have corrected themselves. There's been a few changes they made behind the scenes that people were upset about, and they reverted them. The venture capitalist thing is always a problem because, you know, everybody wants exponential growth. Patreon makes a ton of money just being landlords for content. They're just collecting money by hosting things and interviewing not that much. So I feel like for the past few years, I've been nothing but happy. And the only things that I want from them are them to improve the platform in ways that I think still need to be improved. Like, I really wish that we could get separate RSS feeds for one Patreon, especially with my podcast, because we have multiple mini series, but they're all just in one big feed from 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, if we could divide our podcast into yearly feeds, it'd be easier to find some stuff, and maybe even put some of those old podcasts that are just uploaded, put those on a feed too on Patreon. But as far as I'm concerned, like, nothing has really shaken my confidence in them. And this may be just speaking to the state of, you know, internet writing and being in internet media, but this has been the most stable job I've ever had in my entire life, and the one that's lasted the longest, the one where I can actually get raises and, you know, have health insurance and stuff. Like, it's the most fulfilling and stable job I've ever had.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any major complaints about Patreon. I just, you know, I'm not crazy about some of the business end type things. Like, you know, for example, if we wanted the ability for you to be able to log in independently to Patreon without saying, hey, can you tell me what the two-factor authentication yes. number that just showed up on your phone is, that would cost us like $9,000 or $10,000 a year. Which yeah. seems like a lot of money to pay for me not to have to check my phone at random hours. So, you know, little things like that are kind of annoying. But no, on the whole, like, I'm grateful that Patreon exists. And, you know, between Retronauts and my video patron Patreon, I am, you know, financially stable, which is cool. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in a way that, and you know, obviously I have a job at Limited Run Games, which, you know, that allows me to basically have the foundation to be able to use the money I get from Patreon for like video stuff to actually buy the things I need for my video Patreon, which have gotten really expensive now that retro games have gone up into this huge bubble. But I'm able to actually have the materials I need to cover for videos and books and for, you know, podcasts without going into hawk, you know, because basically people enjoy what I'm creating, what we're creating, enough to support us. And so it mm-hmm. makes it possible for us to create more stuff. So it's great.
And as more people join Patreon, we become a smaller fish in a bigger pond, although we can still, you know, support the podcast, pay ourselves, pay people to host and do art. But I feel like even though, you know, there are much bigger podcasts on Patreon now, my philosophy is, you know, a rising tide lifts all ships. And I just like the idea that Patreon is now the kind of de facto content source in terms of you paying creators. They've just become the de facto way to pay creators and get a little something more for your money. And I will say that some people, we'll talk more about our changes over the years, but some people weren't very happy about the paywall. Most people were. But even if you're not happy about it, it's still, I feel that $5 a month is not a lot to pay for people being able to work independently. And I put my money where my mouth is. This is not just me saying like I'm superior to everybody, but I actually give a lot of money to Patreon because I believe in it and I believe in creators. And I've seen too many friends get laid off and had to go into, you know, non-creative professions because there was just no other outlet. And the people that are still hanging on in there, I don't want them to be able to have to give up on what they do. I just want this to be the default platform. And yeah, I do want to talk about that Patreon reboot, because that was, I think, the biggest change for us in terms of the content we make, because it was a big Band-Aid to pull off, because there is this idea, and a lot of people still can't shake the idea, that because they started as free, podcasts should just remain free forever. They should just be free content, because for the most part, podcasts, when they first started, there were a lot of independent ones, but mostly it was like, oh, NPR is going to put their radio shows online for you to download, or 1UP has things to promote, we're going to make a bunch of podcasts so you go to the website and read the articles, maybe the person who wrote the article will talk about it. But now podcasts are much different. Podcasts, no website wants them anymore, and if they have them, they're legacy shows that actually do make money for them through merch or through just pure exposure. But yeah, for the most part, podcasts are these independent entities, and they are labor. And I feel like I'm glad people are coming around to the idea that yes, for the most part, podcasts are free, but it's fine if you want to charge for just a little more.
Yeah, I mean, you know, every episode of Retronauts that I put together, that's, I don't know, it's between 10 and 20 hours of work for me, pulling together notes, researching stuff, playing stuff, watching stuff. I mean, we're working on a Twin Peaks episode. I'm sitting down and watching 40 hours of Twin Peaks, so I know what we're going to be talking about because I had never actually seen it before now. So, yeah, I do a lot of kind of time investment into Retronauts. It's not just a thing where we sit down and read off Wikipedia at you, despite what some people would like to say. And yeah, it's you know, I appreciate not having to do all that work for free, because at some point I have to, you know, pay for food and you know, support my family and things like that. So it's good to be able to do those things.
Yeah, and we didn't know how people would respond to it, and we weren't sure, although we know our audience is great, obviously. They stuck with us for this long, but it was unprecedented, both the response and the pandemic that happened a few months afterwards, after we made all these major changes. But because of that, we've almost like tripled our revenue, and because of that, we can now you know, offload a lot of what we used to do on our own onto other talented people. Like, Jeremy, you used to do a ton of the artwork yourself. Now you have a lot of people doing the artwork for your podcast. I still have my friend Nick Daniel do the art for mine. And then we have people like Diamond Fight. They put our episodes up on the blog. They have their own column and weekly podcast. They're a new host now. And we also have newer hosts like Nadia and Stuart as well. So instead of us having to come up with six podcasts between us, do all the editing, do all the artwork, do all the posting, which is what we used to do up until, I don't know, 2019. I forget when we actually brought editors along, but editors have been a major help in getting all of these podcasts out on time, because that's another major time sink. So without all these people, we could not function the way we are. And without having to change the Patreon, we could not pay for all of this extra help.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in, you know, people who do things for me shouldn't do those things for free. It's, you know, it just doesn't seem fair. I've always been big on making sure that I try to pay people for work that they do for me. And it's nice to be able to do that. I don't consider, you know, the contributions we get to the site and to the show to be offloading, though. I mean, I guess editing maybe, because that's really time consuming and pretty challenging. And our editors are great. But you know, for me, it's an opportunity to bring in, you know, really talented artists whose work I admire and work with them, and to have people who I think are great, you know, have great personalities, are, you know, unique viewpoints, and to be able to pay them to create stuff for us. That's not offloading to me. That's an opportunity. And, you know, especially like in the case of Nadia, but also Diamond too, to a certain degree, like Nadia has written stuff for me for more than almost 20 years. You know, since I basically started at 1UP.com, I was like, hey, would you like to freelance for me? And she jumped on board right away. And, you know, I tried for years to get her hired at 1UP and then at US Gamer. And when she was finally hired at US Gamer, I quit. Not because of her, just I was fed up with it. And so we've never really had the chance to work together properly in a you know, kind of normal professional capacity. So bringing her on as a co-host was just me kind of trying to right that wrong in whatever way I could. So yeah, like it's been really, it's made me really happy to have just all these different perspectives and different styles and takes as part of the show, because I don't want it to just be me and you. I want it to be a lot of perspectives.
Yeah.
I know both of us kind of have pretty similar viewpoints on things, pretty similar perspectives. Someone like Stuart, who grew up in the UK a few years after us, not so much. Someone like Nadia, actually, we have pretty similar tastes, but, you know, she's still going to bring a very different point of view to things. Same with Diamond, you know. They're a huge SNK fan, whereas I'm totally indifferent to SNK except for Neo Geo Pocket Color. So, you know, it just brings in more variety, more personality, and makes the show broader and, you know, more appealing to more people and able to better speak to the breadth of video game history instead of just like, it's me, the kid who grew up with a Nintendo. How many of those are there creating content on the internet?
Yeah, perhaps offloading was a poor choice of words. I think I was only just thinking of the editing, because I as much as I love editing podcasts, and I still do a few every year just because they're the special ones, like the Christmas one I like to edit, it's a lot of work, and I'm so grateful to my editor, Alex, for doing it. I know you've got a few editors yourself, Jeremy.
I've just one, actually, Greg.
Okay.
And he'll be on an episode pretty soon.
Excellent.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't trying to like take you to task for that.
That's okay.
But yeah, I kind of agree. Like, I actually think I have a knack for editing, and I feel like I'm pretty good at it.
Me too, yeah.
But, you know, after doing those musical episodes, which, you know, that would be like 10 hours of editing to get those together, I realized I can't keep doing this anymore. This is going to kill me. Thankfully, the supply chain shortages this year have meant that there haven't really been that many vinyl releases, so it's going to be a while before I do another music episode. But yeah, getting help on that front, it's just so time consuming and so laborious. And as much as I kind of hate giving up that kind of control, I worked really closely with Greg, and he's been really great about taking feedback. And, you know, after a while, I was just able to step back and say, you've got it, you know, just go for it. And I always really enjoy the music choices he comes up with. Mm-hmm. I think he makes really smart, savvy edits. And, you know, when there's something that I reach out to him and say, like, hey, you know, here's a problem with this episode, be on the lookout for this, he's been great about fixing it. When he's noticed audio issues that I didn't even notice, he said, you know, I took some steps to fix these up. So, you know, I would say, honestly, like, offloading, if you will, the editing process has, for me, at least for my episodes, has improved them.
Yeah.
And so again, you know, it's just great to have that kind of freedom to turn this into, you know, a real proper production, like it was kind of in the 1UP days, when, you know, Andrew Pfister was the guy at the console who was always kind of silently, you know, putting his hand on his earpiece and doing the count-ins and nodding, and then he'd, you know, take the episode, and the next day you'd have like this beautifully presented piece of content that was just wonderful.
Yeah, they were great.
And you were like, wow, did I make this? And yeah, it's good to be able to do that, even though we're independent now and not tied to a large corporation with dozens of extremely talented journalists.
Yeah. Yeah, I think delegating might be a better word, because it's yes, with a personal project like this, it can be hard to let go of certain things because you really want to take ownership of it. Like, at one point in my life, I was doing Retronauts, editing all of those, posting all of those, and I was also doing Talking Simpsons on top of a full-time job. Not editing those, but it was still like hosting a weekly podcast. Like, I don't know how I found time for it, but I did. But even then, it was hard to let go at first. But the people that we've hired have done such a great job of taking over that aspect of the show. And I'm very, very happy with the fact that we can afford it now. So when you see the Patreon total, so much of that goes into just a lot of the labor that goes into the show beyond hosting and posting. There's just so much that goes into it. And again, I'm like you said, Jeremy, I'm glad that we have these different voices, not two white guys born kind of in the same time period with the same upbringing ish.
And this like 200 miles apart.
Yes, exactly. Both suburban, but like different climates, I guess.
Yeah, we're both kind of from the Midwest. I grew up in a different area than you, moved to Texas, but still, like, there's still that background there. So yeah, just kind of the destiny, I think, of us to kind of, end up in the same areas in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. So yeah, having that variety is really important to me.
And if you don't want to talk about the past anymore, Jeremy, I don't know if there's anything else you want to cover as far as the Patreon or the Kickstarter campaign or just what being independent has been like. A lot of the questions actually address that, but I do want to move on to the future unless you have anything else you wanted to say.
No, I mean, I look back at the kind of early days of the show. I feel like people probably will want to hear some talk about like the very beginning early days of Retronauts. And you know, that was such a frustrating process at times, because there were a few people at 1UP who really were into the idea of having a classic gaming show. Thankfully, Sam Kennedy, the EIC of 1UP, was very, very into it and loved the show. You know, he always enjoyed the fact that I had, you know, kind of these strong interests in classic gaming. That was one of the reasons he hired me. And Andrew Pfister was always a big supporter of the show. And since he was the podcast producer, that counted for a lot. And then, of course, we had, you know, the kind of regulars who would be on the show, like Shane Bettenhausen. But, you know, generally there was just kind of a disdain for the idea of having a show that wasn't specifically about a publication or like current events in gaming. And there was a lot of disdain for podcasting in general. A lot of the early days of the podcasting process at 1UP was very much magazine editors under duress.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until, you know, they figured out how to find their own voice that I think they warmed up to it. Like, I don't know if some of the publications ever warmed up to it, but, you know, Computer Gaming World went from being like, God, this, to, hey, we're the Brodeo. And you know, like, people love that. It was a great show. One of the all-time great video game podcasts.
Yeah, I was a big fan.
It took them time to kind of find that voice. And until then, you know, there was just like a sort of general grumbling resentment. But for some reason, that really shifted onto Retronauts a lot. And so it made it frustrating. And you know, once we moved to IGN, it became even more frustrating, because they kind of did the sacking of Rome with 1UP's podcasting equipment. And we're like, oh, all this good stuff. Yes, we're going to use this now. And if you're lucky, sometimes you can use the podcasting room. Also, do you take time to edit your shows? That's weird.
I was scolded by an unnamed employee for having the temerity to say that I edit my podcasts.
Yeah.
In that time period, I was just used to being done with a podcast and looking up to see faces sneering at me through the window. Like, I booked my time in this room. It's not over.
Right. It's not over. Yeah. Yeah. So just in general, like, I feel like the corporate environment is just, it's not good for podcasts, which is a shame, because there's so much merit to this medium. But for whatever reason, it just doesn't fit, I guess, the corporate idea of what content should be. So yeah, moving independently has been great, because instead of being, you know, constantly hounded by, you know, executives and management who want to know what the hell we're doing, or other podcasters who were like, get the hell out of our studio, it's our turn, mm-hmm. we're coming in early. It's just, you know, thousands of people who tune in, or I guess download weekly to the show, listen to it, say, this is great, I want more of it, here's $3-5 a month, and keep it going. And, you know, knowing that we're doing this for an appreciative audience who genuinely care about what we have to say, even if they don't always agree with our opinions, or, you know, can point out that we're wrong about something, it's you know, having things nitpicked by Retronauts listeners now is much more pleasant than it was in the 1UP days.
Yeah.
And it's just a positive environment. And even without really being able to travel that much this year, which, you know, kind of slowly getting back into that, having to do these podcasts remotely, which I'm not really great at, it's still been just miles beyond anything that kind of defined the early days. And I feel that really comes through in the quality of shows now. Like, I go back and listen to the early podcasts, and even, you know, putting aside some of the language that was used, and just kind of some of the fact that we've all grown up as human beings and have, you know, more knowledge about the topics and more maturity as human beings, like, just the organization, the structure, the depth, the sincerity and passion of the podcast is much greater now. I know some people really love the chaos and craziness of the older podcasts, but, you know, that's fine. Some people like different things, but for me, the tone of Retronauts now, and just the I would say the merit and you know, the quality of it is just so much higher, and makes me so much, you know, prouder to be part of it.
That's great.
It's great to be able to, you know, be involved with something fairly continuously for 15 years and be able to look back and say, oh yeah, this has gotten way better. You know, you look at like rock bands that are around for 15 years, and you know, the album released in year 15 is generally not as good as the album released in year one.
Yes. No, I think we're getting better. And I think what people like about the early episodes, Jeremy, there's more of a punk rock feel to them because, I mean, I was in that situation in which a podcast is one of 10 things you're doing that day. You're thinking about a review that needs to go live. You're thinking about an embargo. You're thinking about how precarious your job is and if you should be looking for other jobs, true, perhaps. There's a lot of stress, a lot of pressure. A lot of that made for fun podcasts because they're a little more wild. But I like the fact that for a day of my life now, I can just sit down and say, today is my Retronauts day of the week. I'm going to sit down and take notes, watch all the videos I can, read all the interviews I can, and hopefully I'll have an episode's worth of notes. If not, I can take another day and no one will be yelling at me. This is my career, and I want to make the best podcast I can. I was trying to do that at 1UP, but obviously, you know, we had to do so many other things, which is why, you know, a lot of the episodes are rougher. They had, you know, some incomplete facts, or we didn't have time to go over everything. But now we can focus, and I think that's why now we are doing one game at a time for the most part, outside of, like, a crappy licensed game, which I like to cover. I don't do those one at a time, but I feel like now we can just focus on one game because you and I can sit down and say, let's read everything about it, let's play through it again, let's get the best people on for this, and really focus on one thing.
I would also say that you know, another difference between then and now is that there wasn't really an organized, concrete approach to curating information about old video games online in 2006. Like Wikipedia's, you know, their list of NES games, it wasn't complete. And you didn't have fan wikis and things like that. Now, you know, like, you can go and look at a series and basically, you know, the overview of the Mario series or something is going to be pretty much the same as a Mario episode of Retronauts from 2008 or whatever. Like, we kind of covered the material that now comprises, like, you know, a main fan wiki page. And, you know, that wasn't out there at the time. So, you know, I would say even, you know, even those kind of, like, more overview style episodes, it was still content that didn't really exist otherwise online. And, you know, it just, you know, the nature of information that's available, the nature of the internet has changed over time. And so we've adapted the show to reflect that. It would be kind of pitiful, I think, if we were still doing shows in the exact same format as 2008. But we're not. Like, we've adapted the show. We've expanded it. We've really started to go deeper into topics and, you know, try to do more research and just get more granular with game design concepts and, you know, the relationships and connections between one game and others. And, you know, I don't want this to sound like we're just patting ourselves on our back about how much ass we kick. I mean, you know, to a degree, sure, yes, okay.
We can do this once every 5 years.
But, you know, it's more than that. It's like I am proud of the work that we're doing. But, you know, I feel like it just had to evolve or fade away to irrelevance. And we decided to say, well, let's roll with how the nature of online information has changed, mm-hmm. and, you know, change our podcast accordingly. And I think the results have been really good. I really like some of the deep dive series we do, and I'm looking forward to expanding into more of those. We recorded a Pokemon Generation 1 deep dive a few weeks ago with you know, Kat Bailey and Shivan Butt and Casey DeFreitas from IGN. And you know, I thought, well, we'll probably get through, you know, the first generation Pokemon games this episode, but we ended up talking so much that we're probably going to need to do another one to really kind of cover the full gamut of that generation of games. Hmm. Whereas, you know, back in the early days, 2006, 2007, we just did a Pokemon episode that covered everything. But that wouldn't fly now. But that's okay, because people, I think, are hungry to hear, you know, not just information, but reminiscences and opinions, mm-hmm. and memories about all these experiences that they shared.
Yeah, not to dwell too much on the past. We'll get to the future soon. But you're right. The online information database of knowledge has really changed, where in 2006 to 2009 or so, maybe even later, you couldn't just say, what is this game like? I'll go online and watch an entire long play of it. Now, if there's a game that exists, there is a long play of it on YouTube without commentary. You can see every level, see every boss, see how it plays. That is so useful if I don't have time to play a game or if I can't access it. It's just the entire gameplay is there just waiting for me to experience, not hands-on, but as a viewer.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, the tools for revisiting games are getting better. Like, you know, I'm not really a big fan of emulating games, and it's nothing to do with ethics or anything like that. It's just like, to me, the experience, the, you know, the things like the input delay, that just really breaks a game's enjoyment for me. And there are so many more ways to play games without emulating them now, without actually buying like the original arcade machine. If you have a Mister or something like that, or, you know, like a clone console or original console with a flash RAM cart for playing, you know, for loading cartridges on, or, you know, game ROMs onto, you have access to pretty much the library of Alexandria, and it's growing constantly as more cores come out from Mister. And it really, you know, being able to play games that way is a great reminder of like, oh yeah, this is what that was really like. And, you know, or it's a great way to experience a game that you've never played before and kind of get something that feels pretty close to the arcade experience. And so that's been really valuable for me, mm-hmm. and for kind of putting myself in the right mindset and really, you know, going back and playing an old game I'd never played before and being able to really enjoy it and get the most out of it.
Yeah, and even if it's legal emulation, there are so many ways to play games now, so many collections coming out. The Switch, not quite as versatile as a virtual console, but there's still an okay selection of like Netflix style library of games. Now they've expanded with Genesis and N64. So I think the idea is now, it was kind of a novelty on virtual console, but the idea is now just like, oh, we'll just always make these available in some way.
Well, and you know, even if you look beyond Nintendo Switch Online, you have all the Arcade Archives games coming from Hamster. They release a game every week and have been doing that since the Switch launched nearly 5 years ago. That's like 200, 250 games almost. And some of them, they've started to dig really deep. Like there are games that, you know, I recently covered a game called Pop Flamer by Jalico on, you know, for the SG-1000 version. I did a video on that. I was like, what the hell is this game? I have no idea. And then if, you know, like a month later, Pop Flamer came out on Arcade Archives, which, you know, bad timing, but still it's like really kind of going way off into the weeds, but it's great because it means that there are all these kind of forgotten arcade games that are increasingly coming out. You know, it's not just, you know, the SNK King of Fighters games that Arcade Archive originally dealt with. It's much more esoteric stuff. So, you know, I would just say the idea of appreciating classic games and revisiting classic games is just, you know, it just constantly becomes more and more mainstream and becomes easier and easier to do. And, you know, as long as that continues to be the case, like I just see Retronauts having relevance and having a purpose. And so, you know, that makes me happy, not only as someone who likes and cares about games preservation and wants old games to be available, you know, even if they're kind of bad or weird, actually, maybe especially if they're bad or weird. I just, you know, I'm just happy that you know, I'm not alone in liking old games, which, you know, when I first started in the games press, that kind of felt like I was standing by myself in a room saying, hey, old video games are good just because it's not PS2 polygons, still worth playing. I don't have to do that anymore. Like everyone, I feel like everyone knows. Everyone's kind of come around and said, oh, yeah, actually, pixels are good, even if it's because they're like 10 years old and they grew up playing Minecraft and they're like, oh yeah, Super Mario, he looks like Minecraft because he's all blocky. You know, totally valid.
Or any indie 2D game with pixel art. So I want to talk about the future, as much as we know about the future anyway. So what's happening with us is, yes, of course, COVID-19 happened. During the pandemic, everything became remote. We've been doing everything remotely for the most part. And that just became the standard for podcasts. So everyone is used to remote podcasts now. And a lot of people have just stayed remote. We are now doing in-person recordings. I was not the first one because I was leaving for Canada the next day and I needed to take a COVID test. And I was being very, very cautious, but I'll be at the next one in early December, and we're going to be transitioning back into those, not as the main way to record podcasts, but we're going to get a lot knocked out in those weekends. And for me, at least, I'll be going back and forth between remote recordings and also in-person recordings. And in terms of life stuff, Jeremy, people probably know this about you, Jeremy, but you were living in the Bay Area until 2013, then you moved to North Carolina, and you've been doing Retronauts for the most part remotely, independently, or for the most part, you've lived outside of the Bay Area, rather, doing this this part of Retronauts.
Yes, it was very exciting. You know, we put together this Kickstarter predicated on the idea that the three of us, you, me, and Ray, were all going to be able to get together like every weekend and record. It was going to be very convenient and easy. And then, I don't know, within weeks of the Kickstarter closing out, I think, maybe it was like a month or two, our landlord was like, hey, yeah, actually, I'm moving into this apartment and I need you to leave. And we looked around, and because my wife had been living in that apartment for nearly 10 years and had, you know, kind of like 2005 rent kind of locked in, you know, San Francisco, you can only raise rent like 3% a year. So, she had this like crazy low rate locked in 2013. You know, we looked around and there was no way we could afford what we were paying for, you know, and get anything comparable within the city or within the area, really. And, you know, I had just left a full-time job at IGN with benefits to take a contract job at US Gamer to help launch that site without benefits, which was not the easiest decision to make, because I basically, like, when you count benefits, gave up half my salary. But I was like, well, you know, like, I know what rent is and it's going to be okay. And then all of a sudden, you know, this other factor came in and we lost our apartment. So, you know, at that point we were like, well, gotta leave. So, you know, before, I think, no, it was not quite before the show started, but soon after, within 3 months mm-hmm. of the show kicking off with Kickstarter, we relocated to North Carolina and had to kind of figure it out from there. But, you know, that's been
yeah.
8 years, more than 8 years, and it still managed to work out. So
yeah.
I think we did okay.
And even though you've had to record remotely since then, I think we've all gotten a lot better at it. I mean, in person is ideal, but it can't always happen. And so as for me, the reason I brought that up, Jeremy, is because my personal news is I got married at the beginning of 2021, the worst time of the pandemic. We had a wedding planned for April of 2020, but then the pandemic happened. We all know the story. And of course, my wife is Nina Matsumoto. She's been on the show. She did our new logo, even has done art for us in the past. And my personal news is, people already know this, but I'm going to be moving to Canada at some point, probably in 2022. But as far as how this will all work, none of that will change. I mean, Jeremy was able to make it work, and I will be able to make it work too, especially with all the remote podcasting we've been doing. It just feels like the default now. And I assume that we'll all be gathering again in the Bay Area to do in-person things as normal, and I don't think any of that will change. I'll have to fly in probably more often than I plan on doing, but other than that, I don't see anything being different about how we do this. And maybe I'll get Canadian guests, who knows?
Whoa, that'd be wild.
Yeah, they play video games too. They make a lot of
Nadia.
Them. Yes, besides Nadia. Nadia is going to be living in Toronto. I'll be in Vancouver.
Right. She's on the other side of the country. Yeah. It's like the equivalent of, yeah, from Vancouver to Toronto is like San Francisco to Raleigh.
Yeah.
It's quite a gap.
But yeah, that's my own life experience. It's by the way, it's a very long and complicated process to move to Canada, even if you have a wife there. So it's not easy, but we've been making it work. And yeah, and we'll be doing more conventions. As the time you're hearing this, Jeremy will have already went to Midwest Gaming Classic. I'm staying behind for this one because I don't feel quite as safe taking a few within the country flights, especially because I have to have a clear COVID test to see my wife in Canada for the holidays. But I assume I'll be at the next one that happens. And Jeremy, do you have anything else more to say about conventions and how you think those will be going for the future?
I mean, I'm kind of taking it one at a time. I was able to get my COVID booster before, like, you know, it was sufficient time before Midwest Gaming Classic that I feel comfortable going. I'm going to try to avoid being on the show floor, you know, all that much. I will definitely be wearing masks everywhere I go, plural masks. But, you know, I still feel okay. Like, they have mask mandates in place, vaccine mandates. So it's, you know, it seems like a pretty good sort of test scenario for seeing how this goes. But if it does work out, then yeah, I would like to continue going to conventions. you know, other countries have made life during the pandemic work before they had vaccinations. You know, that wasn't something available outside the US mm-hmm. nearly as readily, especially in Asia. And yet, you know, public life in South Korea and Japan have been pretty normal. And, you know, when they've had emergency COVID outbreaks, the numbers have been much lower here. So, you know, I'm very cautious, very, you know, taking a lot of care with my health and my family's health. But also at the same time, like, I do believe that, you know, if people are responsible, which is kind of a big if, but, you know, if I'm cautious and pay attention to where I'm going and, you know, how I'm in public, I think it's possible to still have, you know, a fairly normal way of doing things despite the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, there's a lot of question about being, you know, personal responsibility and things like that. But I am a believer in the fact that, or the idea that, you know, it's possible to make these things work and still be safe. And so I'm definitely doing, you know, Midwest Gaming Classic next weekend from this recording. I think the next MGC will be in April, so I hope to go to that. I got a solicitation recently about Long Island Retro Expo, which has grown into a really great show, and I'm looking forward to going back to that. So definitely be presenting there next summer. And beyond that, I don't know. It just kind of depends on what comes up. Hopefully Portland will happen. And
yeah.
That'll be, you know, the trifecta of great classic shows for me.
The pandemic happened just as I started doing a ton of live shows, both the Retronauts and my other podcasts. And just as I thought, like, I'm getting really good at this. And then suddenly I'm going to feel so rusty. But I missed a lot of things about life before the pandemic. What I really miss is conventions. They were such a regular thing for me, especially Portland. It sucks so bad that I've missed Portland for 2 years now, and I love going there just for the city itself and for Portland Retro Gaming Expo, which is my favorite expo of the year. I just love it. I get to see my friends Gary and Cole and a lot of other people, but it's been a no-go for 2 years, so I'm hoping it feels like it should happen this year unless there's like a fifth or sixth wave, who knows, but I really want Portland to happen, and I want to see everybody again at like multiple conventions a year. I was traveling so much in 2019, it ended so abruptly.
Yeah, it was tough last year to kind of get used to that. There was definitely a period of just me kind of moping around the house because I literally couldn't go anywhere else. But, you know, I got over it and kind of found a good rhythm. But now that, you know, there's some opportunity to travel again, I've been enjoying that. And, you know, I kind of tested the waters a little bit for personal reasons, family reasons, with my in-laws moving from DC down here. We had to fly up there a few times. So that was kind of a very short direct flight where we could, you know, have a lot of control over the situation and just say, like, do we feel safe doing this? And yeah, I haven't had any alarming experiences in any airport yet, even in Houston, where I seem to connect a lot. Just because it's in Texas doesn't mean that everyone there is, like, you know, completely off their nut. It's just, you know, the loud people are, and they don't get to go into the airport. So
yeah,
it's cool.
You have to take off your mask to be loud, and once you do, you're out of there. Last thing I'll say is, this is just like slightly political, but when it comes to flying, when I have to go to Canada, I have to show my vaccine card, and I have to have a test taken within 72 hours. That might seem excessive, but I would feel so much safer if that was the case with domestic flights. I would fly anywhere, but now I feel kind of sketchy about it still, even though numbers are dropping as of this recording. Let's hope they keep dropping. I'm really hoping for the best. I hope we get out of this in 2022, and things can go back to semi-normal for sure.
There's no better way to start the day than making a fresh cup of coffee in the comfort of your own kitchen, provided you can find the right beans. That's not always easy these days, when there are so many brands and blends and roast levels to choose from. That's what makes Trade the perfect companion for selective coffee addicts. Not only do they send coffee directly to your doorstep, they also have a great system for helping you figure out which kind of coffee that should be. With more than 400 craft coffees from independent roasters to choose from, Trade can help selective coffee drinkers find the one blend they love, or set up the more adventuresome types with a constantly rotating selection of new and different varieties. Trade's onboarding quiz nailed my tastes right from the start, and even if that first match hadn't worked out, they offer a no-risk guarantee. Love your first bag, or they'll replace it for free. For our listeners, right now Trade is offering a total of $20 off your first three bags at checkout. To get yours, go to drinktrade.com/retronauts and use the promo code RETRONAUTS. Take the quiz to start your journey to the perfect cup. That's drinktrade.com/retronauts, promo code RETRONAUTS, for $20 off your first three bags. And this holiday season, give the coffee lover in your life the gift of better coffee too, with their own personalized gift coffee subscription from Trade. Enjoy.
Okay, let's move on to listener mail. I asked you to write in about Retronauts and your questions and comments. I heavily curated these, so we might even read only a little bit of your comment, but I got the core of what you're saying in your little comment there. So I want to start with Adam, who says, cheers to 15 years, longtime listener here. I think it would be interesting to hear you all reflect a bit on a few of the future predictions you made in the past. Now that we're in the future, do you feel the same? As we continue to look toward the horizon, do you have any new ideas? Now, Jeremy, I think you're famous on this podcast for having predicted things, or at least having podcasted about things, and then they suddenly became available. I think that happened to me recently with one of my podcasts, where I released the podcast and like a remake came out the next day, or the re-release came out the next day. I forget which one it was.
That sounds right, and I'm totally blanking on it. Yeah, that does happen a lot. And it's not really so much a prediction. It's like, oh, I'm going to cover a topic, and then some weird thing happens. And it's all totally like blanking out of my memory right now. It happens so often. I can't remember any of them.
I mean, I know,
take it for granted.
I think for me, it was the Chocobo episode. I released that. And then I think the next day, or maybe the same day, Square announced the reboot of Chocobo Racing.
Yes.
But the second part of the question here, do you have any new ideas in terms of just, you know, the show itself? And I think people might assume like, oh, once you cover all of these games, there's really nothing left to talk about. For me, my own stance is that as the line advances for what becomes retro, there are new things to talk about. And also just looking over, I just like skimmed through all 600 posts or whatever, just the titles. And I'm thinking there's so many things that we haven't covered and so many things that we can cover again now that we can dive down deeper or cover one game at a time or cover one era of a series at a time, that I think there is no shortage. And especially now that we have new hosts, they have their own specialty. They have their own expertise. And they have a lot of knowledge about topics that we don't know. And I feel like there's no shortage. There's no danger of running out of ideas for Retronauts, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, at any given point, I have just kind of like this floating slush list of topics I'd like to cover. And I actually have my topics planned out through the end of 2022 already. And those are obviously subject to change. They'll get shifted around and rescheduled and so on and so forth, just as kind of circumstances dictate. But, there's a lot of new topics in there. One thing I want to start next year is a deep dive series into the Shin Megami Tensei series. We recently started a Pokemon deep dive series. I'm sure there are, non-RPGs that we can also talk about. Mm-hmm. That's one of the many things I want to discuss. There's never a shortage of topics. And, I know that, even if we keep going for another 15 years, I still won't be able to talk about all the stuff that I want to talk about. And, we do sometimes go back and revisit familiar subjects or revisit a topic, but that's just because we have new things to say about them, new perspectives. I feel that when we've gone back and talked about, we just recently, in the same weekend that I recorded the Pokemon episodes, talked about Metal Gear Solid 2. I think that episode is due out imminently. Did it come out? No, it hasn't come out yet. But, you know, we've talked about that game before, but this episode was a wholly new conversation, wholly new perspectives, and, you know, an interesting conversation in its own right. So, yeah, there's you know, a great game. There's plenty to say about it. You know, there are podcasts that exist entirely around a single game.
Yeah.
You know, sustained for months and months, years. So certainly there's enough space for us to have, you know, 3 hours of conversation about a game instead of an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Another Adam says, congrats on the anniversary. One question I'd like to ask, if Bob and Jeremy were given the opportunity to work on any gaming series, as in inputting ideas and influencing the direction of the game, what would it be? Bob, go for it.
I'm going to say I don't want to work on a game ever because it's a lot of responsibility and that's not my skill set. But if I had a chance to just tell people what to do, I would, because now that Zelda, Legend of Zelda series is getting very experimental, they're, you know, not afraid to break the formula. I say let's revisit the Majora's Mask idea because people are very happy with that game. People now look back fondly on it and people love roguelikes more than ever. They're very comfortable with the idea of restarting the experience while retaining some things. I say now is the perfect time to retread that idea, give it more than 18 months of development time. And I think that would be an amazing experience. And who knows, maybe the new Zelda will have some of those elements. I don't know yet. We don't know. I would have said Harvest Moon before Stardew Valley came out, but Stardew Valley basically made Harvest Moon irrelevant. I hate to be mean, but they kind of did. And if I would have, you know, forged a new direction of Harvest Moon, I would have said, make it like Friends of Mineral Town, but much better. That's what Stardew Valley did. My other comment would be, I would join the Mario sports teams and make them back into RPGs again, because they kind of do that, but they don't really do it in the way that they used to. And I want to see them going back to making a good Camelot RPG with a golf or tennis experience buried within it.
Yeah, Mario RPGs, or, you know, Mario sports games were the only good Camelot RPGs. And it's a shame that's been taken away from us.
Outside of Shining Force, they made those pretty good.
Yeah, but those were vintage Camelot.
Yeah.
Okay, sure. Man, I don't know that there's any current series that I feel I have strong enough ideas to say, oh, no, I need to put my fingerprint on this. But obviously, I would love to be given reins for a Goonies 3 and put jetpacks in it. Obviously, that would be a great idea. I would also be okay with Nintendo saying, hey, we need another Wario Land game. Can you help us with that? And I would say, yes. And then I would hire a lot of really talented people who aren't me to come up with really crazy ideas. And that would be my job, is just like the guy who gets paid to sit in an office and say, hey, you do something really weird. Nothing is out of bounds as long as it's not obscene. Just go for it. And, you know, we can have different standards of obscenity. So as long as it's not too obscene.
Well, if you make Goonies 3,
that would be okay.
If you make Goonies 3 in the next 3 years, you can get to the 40th anniversary of the movie. And then that'd be a great to re-release with the 8K Blu-ray or whatever. You can have your Goonies 3 video game. So let's write to Konami together.
Cool. Okay. Yes. All right.
So we have Anders or Anders is up next, who says, I drifted from JRPGs for quite some time before playing Shin Megami Tensei 4 in college and having a sort of aha moment where I remembered why I loved the genre in the first place. I wonder if there was a game or series that helped reinvigorate your love of a particular genre. And I take it this is meant to be like things we played for Retronauts. And my greatest memory of this is when we first started the podcast or restarted it independently. And I didn't really ever give Wario Land 2 a chance because I love 3 so much. And playing that for the show was a great eye-opening experience because I did get the 100% on that game. And it's pretty substantial if you do that. So that's the one game I can think of where I really gave it a second chance thanks to Retronauts, and it became one of my favorite games. And in recent memory, I think the RPG Live Alive, thanks to Victor Hunter, I did an episode about that. I never gave it a chance because it's easy to just sit down and dabble in each of the 7 chapters and then move on with your life. But this time, I basically played through 95% of the game, and it's pretty flawed. There's some, you know, unfair and badly made stuff in there, but I feel like I would not have that experience if not for this podcast, and I do appreciate that experience because it was just so unique.
Yeah, I would say maybe not a series, but a genre is golf video games.
Hmm.
As you know, just being sports games and being someone who has zero interest in sports in real life, I just never really gave them much thought. And when I did dabble in, you know, like pick up a golf game, I'd be like, no thanks. But, you know, somewhat for Retronauts, also for my videos, I've had to spend time with golf games and have really come to appreciate that there are some great golf video games, and it's a really satisfying, appealing genre when it's made by a good developer. And I would consider the good developers really to be TNE Soft, HAL, and, you know, I haven't really played that many Mario Golf games, not really spent that much time with them, but I'm willing to give Camelot the benefit of a doubt when it comes to Mario Golf. But that's a genre that I didn't expect to enjoy, but have kind of come around on thanks to, you know, covering them in retrospectives.
Those are the only sports games I like because they're just about stopping a series of meters.
Pretty much, yeah.
And the accuracy that comes down to that. I would say on the flip side, doing this show, it's been interesting seeing the rough edges on games I formerly thought were kind of flawless. I've been doing the LucasArts series. And returning to a few of those, I can respect what they're doing, but a few of them I'm thinking, oh, this is not as intuitive as I thought it was, which is why I'm putting off doing Grim Fandango. Everyone loves it. I have my difficulties with that game. If you're wondering where that episode is, it's coming, but I'm going to break everyone's heart with my podcast.
Yeah, I had a similar experience with Super Castlevania IV, which I covered effusively in a Retronauts Micro several years ago, just kind of off the cuff from memory, playing like the first few stages. And then I revisited it in its entirety for video and was like, oh, actually, this game has a lot of problems that I really had never noticed before. But now that I revisit it with a critical eye, yeah, it could be better. Alan says, my question, you could have a no question off limits 2-hour interview with anyone from the games industry, alive or dead, who would you pick and why?
I have a few things written down ahead of time for this because I know exactly who I want to talk to, and that is Shu Takumi, the Ace Attorney creator, because Ace Attorney games were coming out while I was in the press. Every time they came out, I would ask Capcom, can I interview this guy? And they would say, he's not giving interviews now. He never gave interviews outside of coming over here to promote Ghost Trick. And nobody cared about talking to him, but I cared, and I never got an interview with him, and I never was able to, and I feel like I never will talk to him. So he's the guy I want because I thought it was possible to get an interview with him. A guy that I never thought was possible to interview is Takashi Tezuka. I feel like everyone interviews Miyamoto. He's interviewed so many times, you can read 1,000 interviews with him, and they're always good. He's great. But I feel like Tezuka, he was on the ground floor for all of those important games with Miyamoto. People aren't talking to him enough while he's still alive. And I feel like there are so many stories that have yet to be told by him. And he seems a little more humble. He's not thrown in the spotlight as much. But I feel like he is just as important as Miyamoto in terms of the creation of so many important games.
For me, this is a really easy one. Without question, Gunpei Yokoi. A man who was so influential in so many respects in terms of video game design, in terms of hardware design, and who passed away way too young, more than almost 25 years ago. I feel like we were really robbed in a lot of ways by his death. You know, obviously his death itself was a tragedy, but also he had just left Nintendo, you know, kind of getting out from that sort of sheltering cover-up, what do you call it, like the kind of walled garden of Nintendo where you can't really get access to those people. Sure, that's one way. But also because he passed just before video game coverage, you know, journalism and content really went online. And so there are very few video profiles of him. There's like one interview with him by, I think, a Mexican or Brazilian video magazine that you can find like clips of online, and that's pretty much it. And he had, I'm sure, so much to say about his design process and, you know, just how to make video games and how to make fun, interesting gadgets and how to create fun and entertainment out of seemingly, you know, useless scraps of technology, as he often did. Yeah, I would love to sit down with him for 2 hours and just say, like, please tell me everything.
On the flip side of that, I did get a dream interview, and I've mentioned this before. I talked to Hironobu Sakaguchi when I was at US Gamer, but I was about his mobile game, and I could only talk about that. I was allowed one Final Fantasy question. It was very heartbreaking because he was right there. He was next to me, but I had to talk about this game that was, I guess, was popular, but I didn't care about it. I was just there for him. So that was a little heartbreaking for me. So moving on, Sean says, what's the most memorable reaction you've had upon answering, hey, Jeremy or Bob, what do you do for a living since you've been fully independent? I think actually, so when we talked to Gary and Cole maybe like 3 or 4 years ago, we had a podcast about what we do for a living and how people, they don't know how to answer. They usually just don't respond when you tell them you're a podcaster. But I think in the past few years, I think most people now know what a podcast is. They understand what a podcast is due to certain things. Some of them unfortunate, like the popularity of Joe Rogan that has let people know what a podcast is, the rise of QAnon, but also big things like iHeartRadio. They're getting into podcasting in a big way. They're just becoming more of a commonplace kind of media. Like Will Ferrell has a podcast network now. Celebrities are doing it. I feel like now when you tell people you have a podcast, they understand the idea. The thing is, they might not understand why you're doing it because they just think famous people have podcasts. They might think you're unemployed. You're just having fun while you're unemployed, right? So I think the thing I have problems telling people or letting them know or getting through to them about is that I do this for a living and I make like a living doing this. I think that's harder to communicate than I have a podcast.
Yeah, I mean, I think the hardest part for me has always been just saying like I do X thing about video games and trying to make them understand that doesn't mean I make video
games.
That was like I write about video games. Oh, you like write the scripts? No. And, you know, even now I work at Limited Run Games. But if I tell someone locally that I, you know, work at a games publisher, they're like, oh, you work at Epic, you make Fortnite? No, I don't. So, yeah, it's just, you know, a lot of information. It's misinformation. It's fine. It's just, you know, people don't need to understand what I do. As long as there are people who understand and get it, that's great. That's, you know, kind of what we're here for.
I'm usually happy when the conversation ends because then I have to answer all of these questions. Do you ever talk about podcasting with people, like strangers, or does your gig come first usually with, you know, what do you do?
These days, it's easier to just say I work at a, you know, a company that publishes video games. But, you know, if they really dig deep, then sure. Like, I'll talk about podcasting, making videos, books, whatever.
Okay.
Like, you know, I do a lot of stuff. So it depends on how interested they seem. If they kind of glaze over at the first mention of video games, I'm like, yeah, it's fine.
I guess if you look at the person, you can say, here's what my answer will be. Normally, when I had a website job, if I saw the person and I assume they would know nothing about gaming or the internet, I just would say, oh, I work at a website. And that would be the end of the conversation.
Yeah, Tyler says, what has it been like marketing Retronauts over the years? Did people just naturally follow the show from its one-up days? Or have you had to work hard to build an audience? How will you continue to grow your audience in the future? I guess I should start with this since
sure.
I was in the one-up days.
You were there.
My answer is I'm terrible at marketing and I basically don't do anything aside from like say, hey, on Twitter, hey, there's a new episode. Yeah, I'm not good at self-promotion. So thankfully we have folks like Diamond,
yes,
who runs the Twitter account and does an amazing job, so much better than I ever could have. Really appreciate the work they do. And I feel like it's mostly been organic growth. People, you know, get word of mouth. And, you know, to me, something that's very important is to interact with people who enjoy the show. And, you know, as long as they're not being like total dirtbags about it, you know, whether it's praise or criticism, you know, try to take it fairly, but, you know, just don't be unapproachable. Don't be snooty, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, we're creating a thing that you listen to. That's never been the attitude. I'm always, you know, always really happy to meet people who listen to the show and always kind of surprised, you know, when people are like, oh, I love Retronauts. That always still makes me say, oh, you do. Oh, that's great. Thanks. So yeah, that's one thing I miss about conventions is just getting out there and meeting people who listen to the show and you know, talking to them about their favorite games, what they like about the show, what they'd love to hear us talk about, you know, their own takes on things. So, you know, I'm really looking forward to Midwest Gaming Classic next week and maybe I'll do some organic marketing there by talking to people who listen to the show. I don't know.
Hand out bumper stickers or something. Pamphlets.
Yes.
Yeah, I think the unspoken thing is we definitely benefit a lot from having been on 1UP. It was a medium-sized website back when websites were very relevant in the last era, which they were really relevant when there were a lot of them instead of just the main ones, the oldest ones are the ones that stuck around. And I feel like that gave us a major boost. Without that existing platform, it would be much, much harder to grow. Although starting a podcast that early definitely helped a lot. And I think that I don't know if I'm good at social media, but I do it a lot because I need to promote myself to survive. So I'm doing it a lot. Hopefully I'm not being too annoying. But if I make something, I want people to see it because that's what's important to me. I'm not just making it for myself. And I feel like, Diamond has been a great help in taking advantage of the social media, being very savvy about that, knowing how to promote things. And something that still surprises me, and it happened today, is that people from the olden days, people that were 1UP listeners, are still finding out that we came back. There was one new person on that episode posted today saying, I loved your show in 2010, 2011, and I just realized you guys are back, and I signed up for the Patreon. It's still cool to know that you can listen to a podcast and 10 years later rediscover it and realize, oh, I have to listen to 600 new episodes. That's awesome. So, yeah, I'm honestly still surprised that I have not been screaming loud enough for people to realize Retronauts still exists. But, I assume after 1UP died, people just assume that we all just, became door-to-door salesmen or something. I don't know what happened there. But, yes, I'm honestly still surprised that people are still finding out about us. So I will just be louder and more annoying online about Retronauts. That's my vow to all of you.
Good plan. Bill says, which creative team do you wish was more prolific or would reunite for another project? Thanks for so many years and great shows.
This is going back to my who would you interview question, but it's related to Takashi Tezuka. My thoughts would be get the 2D Mario team back together for one last hurrah. No, the new Super Mario Brothers games do not count. Make them make their own thing together. In the old style, because going back in 2017 and playing Thimbleweed Park, which is Ron Gilbert saying, I'm going to make a adventure game with the hindsight of today, but with the technology of the past, that was such a cool experience. And I want to see every older dev try to do that at least once before they retire. I think it's a really great experience for them to have. And I think what comes out of it is very valuable for the player as well. And that is my own very selfish demand of the Mario team. Get back together, one more 2D Mario game.
I would love to see the Mega Man Legends team get back together. The ones responsible for the PlayStation games, get green light on Mega Man Legends 3, make a new game, Unbeholden by that horrible social media experiment Capcom did.
Oof.
Just, you know, tell us how the hell Mega Man gets off the moon. Bring that same sort of effusive, joyful video game style, 3D action, like bring it back, you know, give us, I think technology now could, you know, kind of bring forward that simplistic anime look and spruce it up with effects and things like that, better texturing, but not overcomplicated. Like, still make it look like a cartoon. That would be delightful. Mm-hmm. I would love it.
Hopefully somebody will make a spiritual sequel in some point in the future. That's not Red Ash. We're not getting that.
That's not Red Ash.
Moving on to Tim. Tim has a question for us. Tim says, what game did you have no experience with when it was released, but you checked out because you'd be doing an episode on it and then fell in love with it? Which game at the time that when you revisited for an episode, you realized it would have been better as a memory? And I couldn't think of any things that I fell in love with upon playing it for the first time for the show. For me, it was a lot of reaffirming things I liked, remembering, yes, these are very good. Like things, especially revisiting things like Demon's Souls before we knew a remake was coming, Resident Evil 4, and Batman Arkham Asylum. Just going in thinking, oh, yeah, these are good. And then coming out the other end saying, oh, no, these are some of the best games of all time. These are spoken of such high praise for a reason.
Yeah, I kind of feel like this overlaps a lot with the previous question where I said golf. I can't really think of anything where I just went into it totally sight unseen and said, oh, this is amazing in ways I never would have anticipated. But, you know, like I said, I did develop an appreciation for golf games thanks to Retronauts. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's it.
Another example I have is... you know, sometimes I don't want to turn everything in my life into homework, and a new game I experienced for the first time, a new old game, was the Famicom Detective Club games. I played both of those re-releases this year, and I was like, oh, I've never played these before. I knew so little about them, and I love both of them, but I also just kind of want to enjoy them on my own terms for now and not turn them into homework for an episode. So maybe in the future there will be one about that series, but that was something I experienced that was old for the first time, and I really, really ended up enjoying them.
Andrew says, what unreleased retro game and what untranslated retro game do you most wish had gotten a release?
It should be easy to read my mind on this. Mother 3 and we must continue hounding Doug Bowser before we he deletes the source code. I think it's going to happen. If Reggie Fils-Aimé did not delete the source code upon his exit, Doug Bowser is just dangling it over a shredder as we speak. So that is something I think, if Nintendo fails enough with their next console, and they probably won't, they will give us Mother 3. That's the reason why we got Earthbound and Earthbound Beginnings on Wii U Virtual Console, is because Nintendo was just like, we'll give you whatever you want. Just please buy the Wii U. Other than that, I think other things that were not translated for US, the Rocket Slime games that are not the DS one, the Advance one, and the 3DS one, I think those have fan translations now, but those were never released in English officially. And also, something that I know for sure was translated by fans was the second Miles Edgeworth game. It was a 2011 DS game, so of course it was not going to come out here in any way. So yeah, those are all the ones that I want to have official releases of at some point in the future.
Yeah, I mean, Mother 3 is the first thing that came to mind for me as well. You know, there was supposedly a Crystalis 2 in development by SNK for Neo Geo. I don't know what that would have been like. How do you take an action RPG and turn it into a Neo Geo game that has to work both for the AES and MVS? I don't know, but I would love to have seen that game have happened, but it did not. And now I will never know how it would have worked.
I guess for this, I don't consider Japanese a big stumbling block anymore. Even though I know very little, I'm cheating in that my wife is fluent because it's her first language. So to a point, I can kind of ask her, what does that say for almost anything? I don't think she would sit behind me and let me play an RPG while translating every line. That might be pushing things a bit too far. But now I can actually have access to someone who knows, who can just on the spot translate something for me. And it's very, very handy. And I appreciate that she does not get annoyed because I ask her to do it a lot. Especially for this show, by the way. So I give her a lot of credit for translating things that I don't know what they say. So Brandon says, when did you realize video games could be bad? And for me, it happened very young in life. In fact, I recorded an episode about this for Gary and Cole's Abject Suffering podcast on DuckFeed.tv. I was at the Toys R Us. I could pick out any game I wanted. I was very young, not reading magazines yet. I did not know what was good. So my mom saw Spy versus Spy. And she said, oh, I love Mad Magazine. I think I was reading it at the time. She loves Spy versus Spy. So I got it. And not knowing that was like a 1984 computer game that was ported to the NES for a 1988 or 1989 release. Not a good game. Not really made for a single player NES experience. Just rotten music. Very sparse and bad graphics. And at that point, I realized like, oh, games can be bad. And I spent my mom's money on this, or it was a birthday present or something. I forget what the transaction was. But at that moment, I realized the world was not so innocent when I played Spy versus Spy for the NES.
Yeah, I don't know exactly when I realized games could be bad. But, you know, I am old enough that I played a lot of arcade games back in the golden age of arcade games. And let me tell you, not all of those games were gold. And that was a very sort of low impact way to discover games are bad, because you would put a quarter in and have a miserable time and say, oh, that's not very good. And, you know, I was very fortunate. I don't remember buying any NES games when I got an NES and had a very limited allowance that made me say, wow, that was an absolute turd. What a stinker. But I definitely borrowed games from friends where I was like, whoa, this game is not good and I don't like it. You know, stuff like TNC Surf Design or Ikari Warriors, things like that. Like, I borrowed those from friends, so they kind of took the lumps for me, and I didn't have to spend my very limited allowance on being deeply disappointed and trying to make the best of a rotten piece of crap. So, yeah, I don't know. It was just kind of always in the background for me. Like, hey, there is the real danger that you could spend money and buy something terrible and not be able to buy anything good instead. So be careful.
Yeah,
so,
I think
thank God for Nintendo Power, right?
With a rental, I could convince myself, oh no, I'm just not good at this. It's my fault. It's not the game's fault. But with it stuck with a game like Spy vs. Spy, I had to live with the fact that it was bad and it was just in my house and I had to play it because there was really nothing else going on.
Sam says, what was your first attempt at games writing? Did you keep a journal? Were you scared to freely express an interest in gaming?
I think this is directly related to you, Jeremy, at least my story, because before I started writing about video games, I was reviewing anime for a website and anime DVDs. So I think a few months after that, you were taking submissions for your Toasty Frog zine, and I wrote for a few of those. So I think technically that's the first time I actually did video game writing and would continue to do it from that point. As for were you scared to express interest in gaming, by the time I started writing about games, I was out of high school, so I didn't care what anyone thought of me at that point. But I do remember in the 90s when I was in high school, I graduated in 2000, it was not cool to play games. People weren't talking about games, and I had very few game-playing friends. A lot of people, quote-unquote, grew out of it. And I think one of the things about younger people is the idea that you stop playing games at a certain age is no longer the de facto rule. I think a lot of people my age thought that and probably still do. But now people just kind of game for life, and it's understood, yeah, like people that are 50 years old are gaming, people that are 60 years old are gaming. It's totally natural. So after I got out of high school and away from peers I was forced to interact with, I had no shame about my gamer lifestyle.
Yeah, you know, back in like junior high when I was playing NES games, I was a little careful about who I talked to about the fact that I spent a lot of time playing video games. But I also had a lot of, you know, good, reliable nerd friends who were just as big into video games as me. We traded NES games back and forth. So, you know, there was definitely like that peer support group. As for my first attempt at writing about games, I don't know that it really occurred to me to write about video games. You know, I was on the student newspaper in high school and constantly wrote like letters to friends and things like that. But, you know, the first time I remember writing about video games was after I launched my very first personal website in 1996. And I didn't immediately write about video games there. It was all like anime and, I think there might have been some music coverage, maybe like something stupid about Star Wars. And it was only maybe like a year later that I said, oh, I should maybe put some video game stuff on here. I think it was, you know, being involved in sort of the message board community around, I don't remember if it was the unofficial Squaresoft homepage at the time or RP Gamer. You know, it was sometime around the time Final Fantasy VII came out. So that would be, you know, about a year after my 1996 website launch. I started talking on message boards and posting and then thinking, oh, like there's, you know, the site that the boards are attached to, you know, they have like letters to the editor, they have fan editorials and stuff. So I wrote some long-winded, pompous editorials, I think. And, you know, from there I was just like, cool, I'm going to keep doing this. And just never stopped. I wouldn't shut up.
Yeah, for me, my final thing to say about this is I spent a lot of time in school to become a better writer, like 8 years in college, and I found that the most rewarding things I was doing was writing about games, which is why I got out of academia and into writing about games, because I was having more fun with it, I was getting paid for it, and people were responding to it more than, you know, a paper on poems or something like that. So that's my final statement on that. So wrapping up, we're running out of time here. Let's do some lightning round, quick answers to these last questions. So Christopher says, besides travel, thanks COVID, what do you find most challenging about producing Retronauts? I will say my number one thing is finding time to research everything. Even though I am still kind of living by pandemic rules and have lots more free time than normal, it's still hard to find time to do everything in a way that satisfies me, but I know people are happy with the episodes. Number two, I will say over the years, a lot of our guests, and we've gotten comments about this, but a lot of our guests have just become unavailable. Either they don't want to be an online public presence, or they now have jobs in which they can no longer be on podcasts. We have a lot of old podcasting buddies that now work at Nintendo. They have rules about that, and we wish we can get them on, but we can't. So especially when it comes to the Bay Area, I feel like I'm the last one left outside of maybe Kat and Ray. Everyone is leaving this area too. So finding not only people who can still podcast, but local people especially, has been a challenge. And that's why COVID has been good for us in a few ways outside of all the bad things, in which we've had to find new people just because of the remote issue. And also more and more people can't podcast with us anymore.
Yeah, for me, it's definitely getting together guests. And you know, a lot of it is just the fact that I'm very reluctant to reach out to people I don't know and impose on them that way. So that's a big limitation for me. Maybe it's just something I need to get the hell over, but it just seems so inappropriate for me to just be like, hey, you don't know me, but would you mind giving me 2 hours of your time? So, you know, kind of working around that limitation and kind of working up the courage to be like, I hope this person doesn't think I'm an asshole. that's always challenging. But, you know, I think we still managed to get by.
I agree.
James says, when will we get a Jaguar episode? And the answer is, I dropped out of math class and cannot do the math.
Yeah, it's, I mean, we're writers, we're podcasters, we're not mathematicians. So I left this to you, Jeremy, because I feel if anyone does this, it will be you probably, not me. I don't know why. I just felt like it feels like Jeremy would do a Jaguar episode. That's not an insult, by the way.
No, I mean, I got to get some use out of that Jaguar that my friend found in the trash and gave to me.
Right. Then you can put it right back in its natural home when you're done with it. we kid because we love. So Sean says, what is the story behind Bob Mackie's hatred of CRT TVs? I understand hating giant Trinitron, but does this extend to PVMs and smaller sets? So my short answer is that for a long time in my 20s and 30s, I had to, you know, move across the country constantly, chasing work across the country, not really having any kind of, you know, economic stability. And along the way, having to move a 32-inch Trinitron CRT TV that was impossible to move just by myself in and out of all these very, very small spaces. And I still live in a small space because I'm living in a space I moved into on a games journalist budget. So I think at some point I'm going to turn 40 next year and I'm going to move to Canada in a bigger space. It'll be the first time I've lived in a non-bedroom or one-bedroom apartment for my entire adult life. And maybe then I will get a CRT TV. But until then, it's out of necessity that I don't do CRT TV gaming. And I will also say input lag has never, ever bothered me, but I understand why it bothers other people. But that is my response. And I understand why people like them, but I just can't fit them in my house right now.
John says, how does the team feel about ROM hacks that add quality of life improvements to older games? For example, save support to Mega Man games, adding more info to the map in Super Metroid. Personally, I'm all in favor of that. I love to see, you know, I love classic games, but they weren't always the most accessible and the friendliest. And, you know, I don't necessarily think that a game should be, you know, just completely reinvented. But I mean, if you want to do that, that's fine. That's your prerogative. But yeah, anything that makes classic games more accessible to a broader audience. I mean, you see a lot of collections that already have rewind and save states built in. So why not build that into the actual ROM itself? I think that's really cool. I love to see kind of new iterations of games. You know, some of the things like the SA1 hacks for Super NES games where they, you know, basically put the games on a faster mapper chip. So things like Gradius 3 and Super Ghouls and Ghosts can run at full speed and you can realize, whoa, slowdown was really good. I can't play this anymore. It's too hard. Like those are really fun and interesting. I'm a big fan of those.
Yeah, I'm like Frank Cifaldi in that I think no retro re-release should come without a rewind feature. I like that even more than save state. Just having it on one button, it's perfect. And it feels less like cheating, you know, to me at least. So Carl says, what topic would you want to discuss if you haven't already? And another question is, any stories from the Ziff Davis days that haven't been told? So my answer to the first question is Resident Evil. We did one episode covering, I think, the first four games, and that was honestly too much. Maybe the first three, I think, was in that one episode. So honestly, I could do an episode per game, and I think that could be my next miniseries after LucasArts is done. And my one experience with Ziff Davis is they bought one up and then fired me. So that's all I have. And frankly, it wasn't a very good experience. So you know what? I don't like Ziff Davis.
Yeah, I think maybe he meant the older version of Ziff Davis before they were hollowed out into an empty shell by venture capitalists. Mm-hmm. So let's see, are there any Ziff Davis stories that I haven't told before? You know, nothing really comes to mind, but that's kind of putting me on the spot. You know, Retronauts was never the podcast where we got drunk around a pool. So it was always pretty buttoned down. Like, you know, Scott Sharkey was a regular. Chris Kohler would come in to record with us. We'd like all get together, go to the studio, record some stuff, you know, shoot the breeze, call it a day. We're very boring. We were like old people even when we were young. It's terrible.
So moving on, just a few more questions here before we wrap up. Josh says, any plans to review more old PC games? Specifically, I would like to hear a podcast about Arcanum. It's in my personal top five games of all time, and I will say, yes, I'm very interested in that. In fact, the LucasArts series is my attempt to get more PC game coverage on the show. I am also a PC gamer. I have been since 96. It's my preferred platform for games, so I love PC gaming. Unfortunately, a lot of the folks I know aren't as into PC gaming as I am, especially the older stuff, so it's more a matter of me of finding new guests and finding new topics outside of LucasArts games, but I vow to you there will be more PC game coverage on this podcast in the future.
Another Adam says, I bought my brother a DE10 Nano after hearing the Smoke Monster episode, and we've been living the Mr. lifestyle ever since. It's been a great way to experience games and consoles we'd previously overlooked. Are there any aspects of retro gaming you would not have experienced were it not for doing the show? For myself, I would say not exactly doing the show, but tangentially doing all the video work that I do. I definitely would not have, you know, ever looked into using real hardware, getting into, you know, playing on CRTs, upscaling, things like that, you know, like really going for the accurate kind of original experience and rediscovering that if it weren't for creating videos. Like I started making videos just on a really terrible handheld clone Super NES, and the results were awful. And someone wrote in and was like, here, I'm going to give you some equipment to make this better for you. And because of that little starter kit, I was like, oh, yeah, this is a more satisfying experience to play and also yields better results. So basically, you know, the entire process of just trying to play games that feel the way I remember them playing was something that I probably would not have discovered without all the Retronauts and ancillary work that I do. And I'm really grateful that I did discover that, even though it's been, you know, expensive. There was a long time where I was really kind of burned out on classic games and really frustrated because I, you know, bought like a twin Famicom, you know, the really cool Sharp made family computer system that has an NES or Famicom slot and the disk system slot built in. And I bought that. I was so excited about it. I got Doki Doki Panic and I got Akumajo Dracula, and I sat down and plugged it into my hotel in Japan to like this LCD flat panel TV and just had an awful experience, and I hated it. And I thought, wow, I guess I just don't like old video games anymore. And I didn't understand about display lag, and I didn't understand about upscaling lag and things like that. Like that was just not something that was, you know, in common parlance in 2008 or 2009, whenever it was. And while I was like, yeah, these are still cool games, but I guess I just outgrew them. I guess I just don't enjoy them anymore. I don't know. There's just something, I don't remember these. This is not as good as I remember it being. But, you know, once I kind of had that cataract vision and the slowdown taken away from me and just went back to playing games on, you know, a CRT from hardware or clone hardware, I don't want to sound pretentious about it. I'm not snooty. I'm not like saying everyone should play it that way. It's just for me, like that was kind of the missing factor to make me realize, oh yeah, like these games were designed for this technology. And when I play it there, you know, the game may not be very good, but at least I know it's me who's, you know, like screwing up when I die in the game, not because it's like fuzzy and slow and everything's running behind how it's supposed to. So yeah, I would kind of say maybe this gets a little bit away from the original question, but that's it kind of re-sparked an interest and enthusiasm in old games and consoles for me.
Yeah, as for me, I don't bring these things to my apartment or house just because I don't have room and budget and things. But I did love going to the retro conventions, and I can't wait to go back because it was my chance to experience, you know, all of the arcade games, all the pinball games especially, and especially going to Portland, visiting both Ground Control and Quarter World multiple times when I'm there, just playing all of these old games. It's fun to go to them and have those experiences because, again, I'm waiting until I have more space to collect some more things, but I just loved seeing them, the arcade games, the memorabilia, and everything at those conventions. I can't wait to go back. So let's do one more question each, Jeremy, and I will take one from Colbin, who says, what's the worst setup / location you have to deal with for recording a Retronauts? Alternatively, what's the best or most luxurious? I don't think anything stands out as particularly bad or good. I will say some of the ones I did not enjoy in terms of just comfort were, I did a few where it was like, let's find a quiet hallway at E3 and just sit on the floor. I mean, they were fine. People enjoyed them, but I just didn't feel comfortable. I can't think of like a luxurious one, although I am happy they stopped doing karate classes at Shared right after we started going there. When we started joining our new our studio for the independent run, there was some conflicts there with some noisy karate folks. And also while we were there throughout, there was a Tong Ren class. And you could not disturb them once you had guests come in. So I was getting the evil eye from some of those people, too. But other than that, I think it's been mostly okay. Can you think of anything?
I would say the worst setup we've had was that time we did the kind of side panel at Midwest Gaming Classic a few years ago about Hey Ankyo Alien.
Yes.
And, you know, it was just like an experimental little thing. And we were standing in front of a speaker. I wanted to record it, but they didn't have anything set up. And it was just like you and me sharing a microphone, standing in front of like this crowd that could barely hear us.
Yeah.
that was not ideal.
Actually, in terms of I was going to say one thing. I saw one picture from that, and it's you talking and me with my arms crossed. And I just thought, I didn't feel like I was pissed off, but I look incredibly mad.
It was fun, but it was also very awkward.
Yeah, yeah.
Luxurious, man. I don't know. There was something kind of luxurious about recording with Alex Fraioli.
Yeah, yeah.
Hit. Just the fact that we had like a retro gaming bar, excuse me, rental shop.
Yes, legally
to ourselves. Like it was shut, like, you know, after hours, just us in there hanging out with him, talking about Dragon Quest. That was a really great experience. It just, you know, felt very kind of like, yeah, this is the dream. Like traveling around, this is like Anthony Bourdain or something. This is great.
Yeah, and
there hasn't been nearly enough of that, in my opinion.
I'm glad Alex still is able to make that work out for him too. Even though he ran into a lot of difficulties with the Japanese government, he's still out there doing it, and I totally respect him for that. So yeah, that's been our 15th anniversary celebration. I vow to you, when year 20 comes, we will have an in-person thing. We have to. I assume we would have been doing it this year at Portland if, you know, that happened. We would have been celebrating there for sure.
We will send 20 lucky fans gas masks to weather the 2026 pandemic so that you can come see us live.
Yes, hopefully COVID won't be on its 40th mutation by then. I'm very optimistic. I really want to see everybody again, and you know, we have nothing but high hopes for the future for the world and for our podcast especially. But yeah, thank you for listening to our 15th anniversary celebration. We're sorry we couldn't get to every letter, but you guys wrote in a ton of great letters. I read them all, and I appreciated everybody writing in, so thanks a lot for doing that. So more about Retronauts, you can find us on Twitter at Retronauts. And as I said up front, we talked about it a lot. We're a Patreon-supported show. If you want to support us, go to patreon.com/retronauts. If you sign up for the $3 level, you get all the episodes 1 week at a time and ad-free. But if you want to sign up for $5 a month, you get advanced episode access on top of access to 2 full-length bonus episodes every month and a weekly column and podcast by Diamond Fight. And I will say that we started doing those bonus episodes at the beginning of 2020, the very beginning. So there are a ton of those that you have not heard if you are not on the $5 level. I think there's probably like 50 by now that are totally new to you. So you'll get access to those immediately upon signing up at patreon.com/retronauts. Jeremy.
Where to find me?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm all over the internet, baby. you can find me on Twitter as GameSpite. You can find me on YouTube as Jeremy Parrish. You can find me making podcasts here at Retronauts, and you can find me at limitedrungames.com. Although I don't really post there that much, I'm doing all kinds of stuff in print and inside the games and so on and so forth. Well, inside the game packages. Anyway, I do a lot of stuff, and I think most of it is pretty darn good. So
I agree.
Check it out.
And as for me, I am Bob Mack. You probably know that, but you can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. I do a lot of podcasts outside of Retronauts. You can find those all on the Talking Simpsons Network. Those are Talking Simpsons, a weekly chronological exploration of The Simpsons and What a Cartoon, where we look at a different cartoon from a different series every week. You can find all those where you find podcasts or go to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. We have a similar $5 level over there with tons of bonus podcasts, over 100. Right now, we're right in the middle of our new podcast miniseries, Blabbing About Batman, the Animated Series. It's a 10-episode exploration of the best episodes of Batman the Animated Series. You can only get those behind the $5 paywall at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. But that is it for us this week. We'll see you again very soon for another new episode of Retronauts. Thanks so much for listening.